Hello and welcome to the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. I'm Ralph Russo, the college football writer with the Associated Press. We are now in off-season mode, and after taking your week off to recalibrate and rest up a little bit, and of course, missing some major news, we are back. To get caught up on a coaching move at Tennessee and a leadership change in the Pac-12 and some other stuff, my guest this week is the great Andy Staples from The Athletic. There is a chance Tennessee has a new coach by the time you hear this, but we'll get into some of where that coaching search could be headed and just how deep the hole is that the Volunteers are trying to climb out of. The Pac-12 is looking for a new commissioner, and Andy has already thrown his hat into the ring. Plus, I wanted to extend a conversation Andy had on his most recent show, the Andy Staples podcast. One on-field change suggested by Dan Rubenstein from Solid Verbal piqued my interest and got me thinking more broadly about how much offense is too much offense in college football. Thanks for listening to the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. You can find us on Westwood One Podcast, Apple Podcasts, just about anywhere you like to get your podcasts. And you can find us throughout the offseason. We might take a break come summertime when things get especially quiet, but not for more than a week. We plan to be out weekly throughout the offseason, hitting on what hopefully will be a pretty normal offseason. So we'll be looking ahead to next season, dealing with some offseason issues, covering any news that's out there, and of course, trying to get a little creative. List radio, as I like to talk about. We'll do top 10s and coaches and players and things along those lines. But we'll try to keep you entertained throughout the offseason and very much engaged, and we'll be here every week. If you like what you hear, give us a good review and a good rating. It helps college football fans find us, and it helps us find more college football fans. And away we go. Joining me this week on the podcast, the first off-season edition of the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast, is the great Andy Staples from The Athletic and The Andy Staples Show. You can find his podcast everywhere you get your podcasts. I'm sure it comes up when you look for ours here at the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. Andy, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hello, Ralph.
It was so nice to see you relatively recently. It was nice to see anyone really this season when we both covered the playoff in New Orleans and the championship game. I actually got to share a meal together, which is always one of the highlights of the college football season, eating with Andy because he knows all the best spots. Though in New Orleans, it's hard to go wrong, frankly. I mean, I'm just, you know, put it out there. It's not like I can find some good restaurants on my own in New Orleans, but it's always fun to have you leading the way. And also, you're good at making plans.
I guess I never want to be the one who makes plans. I always want someone to say, here's what we're doing. But then what if I don't like the restaurant or the food or whatever?
Oh, is that really possible? I mean, is it possible? How often have you gone to a restaurant and thought, this is terrible?
There's been a few times. There was a barbecue place where the guy was on Food Network and had a bunch of TV shows. But I should have known the second I walked in that it was, you know, it wasn't good.
Fraudulent? Like
he
barbecue place?
He built himself up a Disney World and a Disney World of barbecue. And clearly they didn't care about the food. They're close enough to the interstate to want to take your money. And that's what they did. They took my money.
So it's important to realize that even though Andy is considered a connoisseur of food, he really just likes to eat. Like Andy is not a foodie. He is not a food snob. So when I say, like, have you ever been a restaurant where you didn't like the food? I say that knowing that, like, you're not that tough to please. You just like a lot of it, pretty tasty, and at a reasonable and generally at a reasonable price, but not always at a reasonable price.
It's got to be really bad to make me hate it. It really does. It has to. You have to have burned it or just left it completely flavorless. No, I like you take me to Wendy's and I'm going to be happy when we leave.
Right. No doubt. In fact, I just went to Wendy's yesterday, actually. Did myself a Baconator. I think a little much. Was not thrilled with the Baconator. A little too much mayo on there, which, you know, I know is a problem for you.
A single drop is too much, Ralph.
Yes.
Why ruin the flavor of perfectly good bacon and beef?
So I want to get into something here before we dive deep into football. It's more about the the quote unquote off season, and I need your help here as I try to mend my brain after this season. What is your relationship like with Twitter in the off season? Because my brain is fried by Twitter, and I've needed to literally delete the app for the last couple of weeks to try to get my brain back in order. I'm wondering if you kind of have the feel the need to get off of social media during the quote unquote off season.
I just get off in large blocks of time. If you notice, look at when I tweet, they're usually pretty concentrated areas of time. The rest of the time, I'm not even looking at it because it's just not worth it. It's a time suck. And whether, you know, our choice is Twitter because that's kind of how we're wired. We're news junkies. But for other people, it's Instagram. For other people, it's Snapchat. And I just feel like the more I'm away from it, the less I worry about it or think about it. And so I'll just stay off it for a few hours and then, you know, I'll say, okay, I'm going to do this for like 30 minutes and check everything. And if I want to, you know, talk to some people, I'll do that, but I'm not going to spend all day. I'm not going to get sucked into this thing. I did get sucked into it the other day with some Tennessee fans who were mad at me because there was a tweet that set me off where a guy had said, oh, Tony Elliott, clearly this is an agent driven, you know, thing. And I'm like, what? I'm not even sure I know who Tony Elliott's agent is. He has one now, but he didn't have one for the longest time. And like, this is the last guy who would be a self promoter. Like, that's just not true. And so I said that. And I also
if anything, it's been the opposite. And you could make an argument that that has held him back.
I don't even know if it's holding him back. He's turned some stuff down. I think he's being very smart about what he's doing, and that possibly the end game is to succeed Dabo Swinney at Clemson, which would be a pretty good thing. So, I think that set me off. So I went down a rabbit hole where I argued with some Tennessee fans about a coach because they're just, I mean, it's hilarious that they're like, well, he's never been a head coach. I'm like, cool. Neither were Ryan Day and Lincoln Riley. Yeah. But they inherited Ferraris and we are a rusted out Volkswagen Beetle. The name of the car that Tennessee was changed significantly. One guy said 2001 Dodge Durango. One guy called it a Pinto. It was really amazing how many beaters they could think of to describe their own program that they love so much. But they don't seem to grasp that the person they want doesn't exist. Like, but we've got to have a guy with significant head coaching experience. I'm like, cool. Nobody with significant head coaching experience who's really, really good is going to come. Mm-hmm. So maybe you want somebody who's not been a head coach who has a really high ceiling. Mm-hmm. And they're like, no. We want someone with significant head. I'm like, okay, so you want a rebuild guy. You want like a Willie Fritz or a Lance Leipold. No. We don't want that. They got to be really good head coach. I'm like, okay.
Right.
Those people aren't coming because you're about to have an NCAA investigation that is going to lead to sanctions because that is what the university chose to do to get out of paying Jeremy Pruitt's buyout. So I get you want Bill Belichick, but you're not going to get Bill Belichick. So you need to kind of manage your expectations somewhat.
Right. So it is Tuesday afternoon at about noon. Tennessee, as of this moment, does not have a coach. By the time you listen to this, depending on your listening habits, they might have a coach. This could happen in the next day or so. It could happen in the next week or so. I'm thinking
it's going to be John Gruden, Ralph.
It will finally have happened. Right.
The man moves in the shadows when he hires coaches. He's pretty good about that. And then you're like, oh, he hired him. Like with Josh Heupel, we're like, yeah, Josh Heupel?
Yeah.
Was anybody else thinking about Josh Heupel?
Yeah.
That was pretty good.
I assume that this could be one of those, too, where the name will be someone we have not thought about or hasn't been on. I think he even made a reference to, like, if you think they hired me to find one of the guys on these lists, then why am I here?
Right.
So I suspect it might be something along those lines. And you sort of made reference to this. And instead of talking about who they might hire, Though I have some thoughts on that. See, I agree to a certain degree with Tennessee fans on the idea of we would like to have someone who is not in his first head coaching job, because that has been a little bit of a disaster for us. Though I also understand.
Wasn't really Derek Dooley had a head coaching job, and he was, I would argue he was more of a disaster than Jeremy Pruitt.
True. And also, you know, the simple idea that, like, when you say that your expectations, as you mentioned, are way too high, like, you get, like, yes, it's not a bad idea to get somebody with some head coaching experience, but understand that doesn't mean, that most likely does not mean James Franklin. That most likely means
a couple of cuts below. It does. And that's the thing that we're discounting. And I keep saying you're not going to get a guy who's an accomplished head coach. Maybe they do, because maybe somebody's looking for a change of scenery. And they can, you know, Tennessee can spend a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. No,
so I'm not discounting that completely, but I just do think the person who is happy and successful as a Power Five head coach right now, that is probably not the job that they would be seeking. So Danny White would have to talk them into it.
So here's another interesting idea that somebody sort of threw out to me, is that if you're taking the Tennessee job, you might be looking at two rebuilds. So you're stepping into a volatile situation where you already have a bunch of good players in the portal or having already transferred out. Next year is going to be, you know, to use our friend Bill Conley's phrase, kind of a year zero at Tennessee. Mm-hmm. I think expectations will be super low. You will be probably piecing together a roster. But you could also be going through another period of extreme turnover when the sanctions finally come out, and now all of a sudden you have a bunch of kids who have one-time transfer exceptions. First of all, they might get carte blanche. They might have gotten carte blanche anyway to move, because we saw some of that with Ole Miss. But now you'll have the one-time transfer exception, and you could see a situation, depending on how hard they get hit, that a year or two, or maybe even 3 years, the way the NCAA moves on these things, you're going through you've gotten a little momentum going, and now you're going through another rebuild, another transition period.
I'm actually fine with that.
No, I'm fine with it too, but I also understand.
I'm telling you why, as if I'm the new coach at Tennessee, why I'm okay with that.
Okay. Okay.
Because it allows me to more quickly make the roster in the way I want it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have a problem with that. Like, if I'm the guy getting that job, I expect that. It's why I had my agent get me that seventh year on the deal.
Right.
And this person's going to get a 6 or 7 year deal. I would bet seven, mm-hmm, if I had to guess.
Yep.
If you're getting someone who is a sitting head coach, who's pretty good. Now, if you're getting Jamie Chadwell from Coastal Carolina or somebody who's making the step up, then you could do a more conventional contract, because you're giving them a massive raise anyway.
Right.
But if you're trying to
tripling the salary. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're trying to pry someone away from a Power Five job, or maybe they're an NFL coordinator or something like that.
Or even a good group of, like, high level group of five job. Right.
You're going to have to. Yeah. You're going to let's say Luke Fickell, right, who I don't know that would be interested in this job, but you would have to pay a fortune, and you'd have to pay it over a long term. And there would have to be a lot of security built into that, because, you know, this is, I would be leery as a coach of a university that just instigated an NCAA investigation to nuke the previous coach.
Right.
Like, that would bother me.
Right. Right. Yes. That would make me a little less trust. Now, though, the good thing is you have now brought in Danny White. And if this is, I almost equate this situation to, I'm interested to see the way it plays out, if it plays out in some ways the way Auburn played out, right? Where all of a sudden the president empowered the AD, told all, mm-hmm, the boosters, y'all can go take a flying, you know, F. And then Alan Green got to hire the coach. And all the boosters sort of got sidelined. And I'd be interested, you know, again, you bring in Danny White here and you empower him. He has no, he is not beholden to any of the big money boosters. Right, because those are not the people who got him this job, as far as I can tell.
He doesn't really know them.
Right,
and so
if you empower Danny White to do this and take this job, I think that's the other thing. You didn't just hire Danny White to hire the coach. You hired Danny White to sell the next coach that, hey, you can trust us. We're not what has been here. We're not that leadership structure. We are going to be a very different leadership structure, and we're going to be here to support you.
Yeah. But here's the problem.
You sound like someone who has covered Tennessee.
Yeah. The problem with that, and I agree with that, and I think Danny White is a very capable athletic director. I think that was a great hire. But this is a university that has undergone a lot of leadership changes at the top. Not the top of the athletic department, the top of the university. They burn through chancellors. They burn through university, assistant presidents. And that's the issue. You know, they don't have the same chancellor they had when all the John Curry stuff was going on. She got ousted. Beverly Davenport got ousted after that, not just because of that, but somewhat because of that. So the issue you have is at the top, they're going to churn a little bit unless for whatever reason they're not going to. Like Jimmy Cheek is probably the longest serving, and it's interesting because Jimmy Cheek presided over some pretty crazy football stuff, including the whole Lane Kiffin deal and the Derek Dooley stuff. But it's just, there's a lot of turnover. I'm looking at it right now. So since 2003, you've had, now they've changed the format a little bit because they had, chancellor, assistant president, all that. But,
right.
But you've got, if you include interim, six different people.
Mm-hmm. And that's in the chancellor / president's chair.
Right. That's in the on campus. This person presides over this campus. There's also Joe DiPietro, who's the university system president, mm-hmm. who presides over the entire system of University of Tennessee campuses. So it's a lot. Mm-hmm. And we talk about alignment. We talk about, Oklahoma is kind of the prime example and the most extreme example to use of alignment, where David Boren was the president. In 1998, he hires Joe Castiglione to be the athletic director. Later that year, they fire John Blake as the football coach. They hire Bob Stoops late that year to be the football coach. And they serve together until Stoops retires in 2017. Now, Boren has since retired as well. Castiglione is the only one left working. But president, athletic director, football coach together for 18 years.
Yeah.
You're never going to see that again. But that's the dream, and that's what every coach wants. That's what every AD wants, and that's, given its history during this century, not what Tennessee is going to give you. So you have to be aware that leadership may change at the top, and you got to deal with that. Now, having Danny White as your buffer, if you're the coach, I think that helps a lot. I think having him as your buffer between the administration and the program will help you deal with that. Now, interestingly enough, Danny White was at UCF, which was a very aligned situation when he got there. John Hitt was the longtime president. Like, John Hitt became president of UCF when I was in high school in Orlando, mm-hmm. and was still the president until just recently. So that stuff matters. And I know as sports fans, we don't pay attention to it as much, but it is probably the reason when you see a program that doesn't have stability, and it's not an obvious, like, well, it's this guy. He was the problem. And if it seems systemic, where there's always a problem, you may want to look up top, and that's probably your answer.
And those jobs have become more volatile too in recent years.
Yeah.
Like, that used to be, oh, I'm a university president, I'm good. Like, I'm going to retire in this job. That's not really the case anymore, because there's a lot more pressure in those jobs on those people to create revenue streams and to build, mm-hmm. and to get bigger.
And they're politicians. I mean,
and they're part politicians, part fundraisers.
They get quote unquote voted out, just like other politicians do.
Right. And so I that leads me, like, a good example in talking to Larry Scott last week after he announced that he would be stepping down. He had mentioned to me in his time, I think it's 11 years at the Pac-12, there will have been 30 university presidents. I think maybe one is currently in the job that was there when he was hired.
Yeah. Well, there were two that mattered specifically to him.
Right.
Who protected him through thick and through thin. And that helped him last probably a lot longer than he should have. But Michael Crow at Arizona State and Ed Ray at Oregon State were the ones that protected Larry Scott when,
and Crow is still there.
Really need protecting. Yeah. Ray is gone at Oregon State. Right. Penn State fans also know Ed Ray. Very yes. very well.
So let's get into that job, because I know you're a candidate.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've cut my price to 1/3 of what Larry made. So I'm ready.
Quick math is about 1.8, I think, or
yeah. I don't do math, Ralph. That's beneath me. I'm going to hire people to do math for me.
And again, so I bring this up because, as we said, you know, the turnover at the top it was a big reason why things have come to where they are with Scott. He was brought in by university presidents to do one job, never really connected with the athletic directors. The interesting thing about Larry Scott is he was a visionary for about 4 or 5 years, and then he became an idiot. Because that's
Coastal. And I would argue that he was.
That's the nature of the business.
Too strong a word.
Yeah.
But I would argue he wasn't a visionary. He just showed up at the right time. And well, and now there's an intelligence to knowing to throw your hat in the ring at that time.
The SEC had just done a bad
TV deal because of an economic collapse, and they were the next to market as everybody was recovering from that 2008 collapse, and so they look like geniuses. Until the Big 12 and the Big 10 made their deals, and it's like, oh, never mind.
So, yes, timing is everything in life. Sometimes you step into a position at the right time. But he was also charged with doing, with sort of changing a culture there. They were a very mom and pop kind of shop at the Pac-12. So while timing and I think going outside of the college sports sphere at the time seemed like a great idea, because it rejuvenated or sort of recharged and recalibrated the Pac-12, I would also say that it also was his undoing eventually, because he came into this position saying, okay, you work for the university presidents and chancellors. Okay, great. I'm going to work with them and I'm going to execute their strategy, not realizing that, no, that's not really what the job is. The job is you kind of work for them, but you're also sort of this conduit between them and the athletic directors, and you have to sort of include them. And he never really did. So there was a whole bunch of stuff going on there where, again, like, I think the timing was right, but I think he was the right person at that time to a certain degree. And then all the things that were to his benefit early on became weaknesses as his tenure went along.
Yeah. Well, and it was a conscious choice to cut out the ADs. It was these guys don't sign my paychecks. I don't serve at their pleasure. I serve at the pleasure of the presidents, which is as you can see, a pretty good way to keep yourself secure for a while and to keep getting new contracts. But it's not a way to run the organization effectively or to engender a lot of faith in you as the commissioner by people who do matter. Like, the ADs matter. Their opinions are important. And a good university president, especially if that person knows they have a good AD, values the opinion of the athletic director. And so when you have all the ADs telling their presidents, this guy's a clown, that doesn't bode well for you.
Right.
That's when you got problems. And yeah, you know, look, the ADs are on the ground. You need to know what's going on the ground. And I think that was one of the bigger problems, is he came in with all these ideas, but failed to monitor what was going on the ground. And that's what always got him. You know, having the general counsel overseeing football officiating and actually making a call on a replay during the game. Like, that's the dumbest thing ever. Like, how you let that happen is inconceivable. Mm-hmm. But they didn't worry about the granular on the ground stuff enough to care. So that's how stuff like that happens. And you're like, that happened. We'll change it. Like, no, you should have had something in place to stop it before it happened. Why was that even allowed to happen? It's because you're not paying attention.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say not paying attention, but I also, again, would argue it's not fully grasping what the true nature of your job is. Your job is not just to implement the president's plans and work with the president. Your job is to do these other things are your job.
Well, you want me to tell you what a Power Five commissioner's job is? Well, make sure your football teams are good and make good TV deals. That's your job.
And part of that job you can't control.
Right.
Which kind of sucks. And that's where I'll always defend Scott. Well, you can control a little bit. I will always defend Scott a little bit in that, like, he can't make USC function properly. He can't make.
I would argue that he can help them a lot more than he can do the other thing. The one thing he can't do is make Cal fans care.
Yeah, and I was going to say that too. I agree with that. You've said that a lot.
So that's your problem with the TV deal. Like, you can't do that. You can't make a group of people who don't care. Like, I'm sorry, Cal fans. You don't care like Mississippi State fans care. You just don't.
Yeah. And there's not as many. And there's not as many of them as there are Minnesota fans.
Right. So that's a problem for the Pac-12 commissioner that the Pac-12 commissioner, whoever it is, can never solve. That's just something they have to work around. But you can help USC function a little better by, I don't know, don't have seasons where they don't have an open date. Don't have seasons where they've got to play a road game on a Friday right after a road night game on a Saturday. Like, that's not hard. That's just fairness. Simple fairness. And you say, well, you're saying they should treat USC differently. No. I'm saying they should treat USC fairly. Like, treating your teams unfairly like they did with USC. Arizona had a season like that where they had no open date. Like, that's just stupid. Mm-hmm. It's bad business.
Yeah. Right. When the SEC had a chance to remake, like, the perfect example, when the SEC just remade its schedule heading into the pandemic season, into last season, it did not put on Alabama's schedule, oh, we're also going to add Florida and somebody else good from the East. I don't think there was anybody else good from the East. We're going to add Missouri.
We're going to add Florida twice.
Yeah, right. We're going to put Missouri on there with a new coach, right? They threw Kentucky on there. I know Kentucky's generally, this is not your dad's Kentucky, but nonetheless, that's an example. In other words, the SEC consciously thought, listen, we don't want to overburden our best teams here. So we're not going to load up, the Big Ten did something similar when it finally got its act together. Anyway, the Pac-12 has been notorious on scheduling poorly and not looking ahead and going, okay, who are our best teams here? Let's give them a path that is not necessarily easy, but conducive. Let's use the word conducive.
Right. Don't overload them just as you wouldn't overload anybody else.
Right.
It's not smart. There's another, try to make it as even as possible for everybody.
I wonder if this is another small example. It's not something that would have been really on the radar of a lot of people. But yesterday popped into my email two announcements from two schools, right? USC and Alabama both hired offensive line coaches yesterday. And Alabama's
offense is an unfair comparison. But go ahead.
It's super unfair. It's super unfair. It's also unfair to Clay Maguire, who I don't know, and I'm sure is a fine football coach who has coached as an offensive. He was an offensive coordinator at Texas Tech. I think he was most recently at Texas State. But USC hired Clay Maguire to be its offensive line coach. Again, previously at Texas Tech, I think he overlapped with Graham Harrell there. So that's fine. That is totally fine. I'm sure he is a fine coach and has the potential to do a fine job. And Alabama hired a former NFL coach in Doug Marrone. Now, that is an extreme example of, hey, this is one of the reasons why these two programs and these two conferences are not the same. Alabama can afford to hire Doug Marrone and bring that guy.
I will argue, Ralph, that that's not true. It's not Alabama isn't money whipping Doug Marrone into taking that job.
Well, that's
all Alabama is reducing what the Jags are paying Doug Marrone by a certain amount.
That's a fair point. Okay, that's a fair
point. So any other school could do the same thing. But Nick Saban has spent, I'd say, I'm trying to think, when did Billy Napier get fired from Clemson? Because that was kind of the start of all this.
That
was after 2010.
Yeah, it was the year Dabo had to revamp his staff. So, Chad came in 2011. Yep.
So Nick Saban has spent 10 years building this sort of factory of you know, coaches who've gotten fired or fallen on hard times, whatever it is, giving them a chance to rehabilitate their image at Alabama. Mm-hmm. And the results have been so good that now a guy who just got fired from an NFL head coaching job goes, you know what? I could learn something there. Like, that doesn't have anything to do with what Alabama can pay. Mm-hmm. Because honestly, when this started, they were paying them nothing. And they still do. Like, the analyst guys make like 40 grand a year. It's just that almost always it's somebody who's being paid by somebody else because they just got fired who wants to go learn something they didn't know before. And that is long game by Nick Saban. That if somebody in the Pac-12 had thought of that, they could be doing it too.
Let me wrap up this segment by touching. I didn't think I was going to go here, but I do want to stay here for a second. And Saban and the car wash. These fired coaches go through there. They rehab their reputations. Some differently than others. Some maybe need a sort of a credibility aspect of their reputation, and some just need to learn some new things and be positioned next to Saban to relaunch their careers after being fired. Bill O'Brien is now the offensive coordinator there. So that this is three straight offensive coordinators he has hired from the NFL. Brian Daboll after Lane. Brian Daboll, Sark, who was with the Falcons, and Bill O'Brien, who's now coming back from the NFL. I was talking to Chip Kelly about a story on Ryan Day, and he had said, you know, the thing that Ryan and I really learned in the NFL is this idea that it's you are a different team every week because the matchups are different every week. So you can't just be one offense. You have to be lots of offenses, and you have to sort of think and game plan differently. Like, you can still have your best guy and you're still going to throw the ball to your best guy, but every week you're going to face different sort of challenges, and you have to be able to sort of layer a lot of offense on and I think Day has done a good job of that in bringing that to Ohio State. And it certainly seems like that's the advantage that Saban is looking for. He is trying to sort of create an NFL offense, not in the fact of specifically we're going to run this type of play or these type of plays, but we're going to sort of put a lot on our players. So they are going to be a sort of doing, we're going to recreate ourselves every week, depending on what is necessary.
I think you're right about that. And, you know, in the NFL, it's easier to do because you're not calling 17-year-olds all the time.
Right.
And at Alabama, that's easier to do because you have analysts to handle some of the grunt work. So that when you are calling 17-year-olds, that's great. You're done. But then you get done and all the stuff you need is cut up there for you and you can work on scheme. I do think that is a huge reason Alabama's offense has evolved the way it has. But I'll give you another reason for it. And it's a recruiting reason. And it actually probably makes it where they don't have to talk to 17-year-olds as much. Their job, what they want to do, is create first rounders. Mm-hmm. You create first rounders. Five-star recruits beg to come to you because we can talk about name, image, and likeness, all that stuff, all we want. An eight-figure signing bonus is the ultimate reward. And Alabama has proven that you have the best chance of getting one of those by going to Alabama. And before, it was, you know, it was kind of position by position. Like, if you played linebacker, you had a real good chance of doing that. If you played receiver at Alabama, maybe not. You know, they went from 1968 until Julio Jones in 2011 before they had another first-round receiver. Mm-hmm. Now they've had Calvin Ridley, Jerry Jeudy, Henry Ruggs. They're going to have Devontae Smith. They're going to have Jalen Waddle. Like, they're just pumping those guys out now. And so it's sort of the thing that makes its own gravy. So if you have coaches with NFL experience who can train guys that NFL teams will want to draft early, that just makes it easier to recruit too. And that I did a study recently where I looked at how many draft picks each school had produced in the last 10 seasons. And Alabama obviously was number one. I think it was something like 92 draft picks. But what was more amazing was the median selection position. Mm-hmm. It was like 59. Yeah. Like, For example,
they're basically producing
the Texas one was like 160.
Yeah, they're producing top, you know, first two round draft picks.
Yeah, you're middle of the road. If you're a middle of the road draft pick from Alabama, you're getting picked in the second round.
Yeah,
that's insane. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is, even if you're not getting the best money in the second round, teams have invested in second round picks. You are going, they're going to give you more chances than they would if
you're
going to,
you're going to make the team. You might even be penciled in as a starter day one.
Yeah.
You are going to get a significant amount of money in signing bonus, even if it's not generational wealth. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of money.
Okay. So we touched on some offense there. I want to take a quick break. I'm talking to Andy Staples on the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. Andy, of course, is with The Athletic and the Andy Staples Show, which comes out, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 times a week, depending on how ambitious Andy is and how much news is going on. Andy likes to talk. So you'll never, like, I think you probably, I'm guessing you would do that show every day.
If people would join me, if I had a budget to pay guests, I would do it like 10 times a week. Because if I paid guests, and really guests, you know, they don't want much. Like gift certificates they'll take, free t-shirts they'll take. Yeah. So maybe I'll get some t-shirts printed up so I can get more guests.
Okay. Well, and I've been a guest, and I would certainly take a t-shirt. But we're going to come back after this to talk a little bit more. We open the door to the idea of offenses and where they're going. And I listened to Andy's last podcast, and there was a couple of ideas thrown around. And I think I want to continue that discussion. So we'll do it right here on the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast right after this.
The market is constantly changing. The Marketplace Minute keeps you up to date 1 minute at a time. When you're just waking up.
Alexa, play Marketplace Minute.
All operators file for bankruptcy.
On your way to lunch.
Hey Siri, play Marketplace Minute.
Says it's been spending more on hiring.
Right after you tuck in the kids at night.
Hey Google, play the Marketplace Minute.
Or upward swings in indices in Europe.
The Marketplace Minute, a podcast and smart speaker briefing updated 3 times daily. Ask your smart speaker to play the Marketplace Minute. Listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your shows.
We're back on the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast, talking with Andy Staples from The Athletic and the Andy Staples Show. So, Andy, as I've stated many times, I believe all of the conversations we have with our colleagues are now podcasts, really. I mean, we only talk to each other when we're recording for content. And I say that is, I, of course, listen to your podcast often. And recently you had a conversation with Dan Rubenstein from Solid Verbal. And that conversation with Dan was sort of a continuation of one of their episodes, he and Ty Hillenbrandt's episode. So this is kind of, so I sense what's happening with the college football podcast landscape. It's becoming a little like the Marvel universe, where we're all sort of interconnected in some way. We listen to each other. We think, oh, that's a good idea. Let's continue that thread conversation.
I warn you,
here.
Ralph, be careful. You're going to get a 15-minute diatribe about WandaVision if you're not careful right
are
now.
You, well, I'd be up for that. Have you been watching WandaVision?
Are you? Yeah, of course.
Are you down with, like, because my daughter is like, I can't believe they're only releasing one episode a week. Like, she's physically, like, pained. She's angry to the point of wanting to hurt somebody that she can only watch one episode.
They did it with The Mandalorian, so they're going to do it like this. Yeah. Netflix is the only one that is not going to go to the once a week model. They know where their bread is buttered. But no, I do love it. And partially, I don't know how your daughter feels about this, because she did not grow up watching old 50s and 60s sitcoms. But Ralph, I imagine you did.
Right.
I know I did, because when back in the 4-channel days, when you had 3 VHF channels and 1 UHF channel, that is what they populated television with.
Right.
The Andy Griffith Show, the Beverly Hillbillies, Mary Tyler Moore, all that.
Dick Van Dyke
Laverne
Show, which is what the WandaVision was playing off of.
Yep. No, the Dick Van Dyke Show, like when he comes off the step on the sunken living room, and then you get the little sound effect. I mean, come on.
Yeah, and he trips over the ottoman. Yeah, exactly. So and the third episode, that looked like the Brady Bunch house, right? They were sort of playing
exactly.
The Brady Bunch house with those stairs,
which means we're probably, are we getting like the Jeffersons or Three's Company next week? I hope so.
Could be all in the family too. That would be an interesting twist on it, right? You have like the Archie's chair.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if they go late 70s or if they go straight into the 80s. That's what I'm trying to. Or do they go away from the sitcom and go like into the Donald P. Belisario universe, like a Magnum PI episode?
Well, at some point, could they do like Family Ties? Like what would be the
Well,
what was the other Family Ties and the with the Olsen twins? That's
Full House.
Full House. Thank you. Yeah, Full
or,
House.
Or what about Perfect Strangers? I mean, you get some wacky relative show up from I can't remember. I can never remember the Wanda's home country's name. But yeah, like a wacky relative, their own Valky Bartakama shows up.
So yes, we have become our own Marvel universe. I believe college football media has become some ways like the Marvel universe, and we're all going to be overlapped and intertwined, especially in our podcast. So if you've listened, so this podcast will in some ways be somewhat the sequel to like the third in a trilogy of the Solid Verbal that then moved over to the Andy Staples Show and is now on the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. And where I'm taking the thread is you guys were talking about ways to improve college football. And the one thing in particular that I liked was this idea that if you punt, you give up a point. You give up a point every time you punt. And now stick with me for a second.
I love the idea so much. It's Andrew, one of the Solid Verbals listeners, and not me, even though I am a Solid Verbal listener named Andrew.
So, but I think here's why I will improve it. I think you guys framed it a little. Your framing was off. You're not giving up a punt if you're not giving up a point if you punt. The defense is earning a point for a stop. And I will take it to now the next degree is, how about we just give because the defense is
but they don't earn a point if they stop you on fourth down.
No, but what that's my next suggestion.
You are surrendering that point.
No. Because
you have no guts.
No, but I say let's take it to that level. We have become so skewed offensively in this game. Like, and listen, I love offense. We all love offense, but I mean, at a certain point, like even like home runs became devalued in baseball. I'm a big baseball fan. At some point, like there were too many home runs. Like there could be too much of a good thing. Are we getting to the point with college football where offense has almost become so good it's devalued? Are there ways we can increase the value of defense? So I say not you lose a point or you give away a point if you punt, but you earn a point on defense if you get a stop, whether it's a punt or a four down stop.
No, because I want to disincentivize punting.
But you will still
care about what happens to the defense.
But you'll still disincentivize punting. You will still create the same. You will disincentivize punting. You will get teams to play more four down football. But you're also
Still lose a point either way, Ralph. So you've taken away the penalty.
They're
going to lose a point with if they don't make it or if they punt. So you've now make it where they're going to lose a point like 80% of the time. So they'll just punt because they're like, I'm going to lose a point anyway.
But I want to get more value on the defensive side of the ball. Again, this is just my suggestion here. I want to get more value on the so that leads me to this, though. Do we need to come up with more rules to in some ways, again, can you have too much ice cream? Are we getting too much offense in the game? And do we have to start looking at
Ralph? I'll tell you the same thing I told Jim Delaney when he used the too much ice cream. There is no such thing as too much ice cream.
I love ice cream too. So it's hard for me to get too much ice cream. In your evaluation of what needs to be done to improve college football, not that it's not great, but like everything, we should always be thinking about
making more fun.
We should always think about making things more fun. What I would suggest is we might need to tamp down the offense to make it more fun. If there's no expectation,
no, we don't, Ralph.
No, but if there's no expectation
Ralph,
of
you
a
and
stop,
I sat together through 9-6 in overtime.
I don't want to go back to 9-6.
Never again.
I don't want to go back.
You know what? If it winds up being 68-58 or whatever the score that Baker Mayfield Patrick Mahomes game was, great. Don't care.
No.
I'll take those every time.
I'm not trying to go back to 9-6, but if there is no expectation to ever getting a stop, then all of a sudden the touchdowns become less exciting. That's
my
point.
But there is an expectation of getting a stop because if you penalize the punt, they're more likely to go for it. If you stop them, you're in better field position, giving your offense a much better chance.
Okay, but it's two. This is a separate track. Okay, you've peed on my just give the defense a point if they get a stop of any kind. I understand you don't like that. I would still support that. I still think that's a good idea, and because I think it does what you do, what you want, and it adds a little extra emphasis on the defense making some stops.
People would just punt the same amount because they'd be like, oh well, I guess we'll just punt.
Oh, see, I disagree. I disagree because I think that they won't want to allow the defense to earn those points via punt, and all those, you know, fourth and less than 10 from inside the 50 punts will go away. All of those
they'll all go away under my plan too.
I'm trying to expand on I'm trying to take your plan and make it better. It's not even your plan. It's Andrew from the Solid Verbals plan.
It's Andrew, the Solid Verbals plan. No, I'm telling you right now.
So you don't think there's anything that needs to be done? Again, let's take it away from that idea and to like this idea that we might need to create a little more value
I'll give you one thing that you could do right now that would help defenses tremendously. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what you would call this official, but you're going to add one official to the crew and they're going to stand 3 yards from the line of scrimmage on the sideline, and they will look down that line. And if anybody with a number 50 through 79 crosses that line and the ball gets thrown, they drop a flag. We're going to actually enforce that rule.
That's the one that coaches have been.
That would be good.
Yeah, that's the one that coaches have been pounding the table about, the illegal man downfield. It's 3 yards in the NFL. It's 1 yard. No, am I getting that? No, it's 1 yard.
3 yards in college, one in the NFL.
It's one in the NFL. And what they've been, you know, defensive coaches have been lobbying for is to just make it 1 yard in college. But you're saying,
I don't want to do that. Let's leave it at three.
You're just
I'm
saying
good with that.
You're just saying to enforce it better.
Enforce it. I mean, you got to be like 6 yards down the field to get called on that thing now.
Yeah, I think you're wrong. I think that horse is way out of the barn. And even if you do enforce that, the offenses are so. See, that's the thing. I don't think a rule is even something that will tamp down the offenses. I think everything has built up into the offensive side. The 7-on-7 football is an advantage to the offense.
Here's
everything
the problem,
is an advantage to the offense.
Any rule you make that gives the defense an advantage is probably going to be viewed as an anti-player safety rule.
No, that's true.
And so if the goal is to make the game safer and it also happens to make the game more entertaining at the same time, I don't think that's a problem.
I do get that, but I do think that at a certain point, if there are no expectations of a stop, if you know the team with the ball last is most likely to score, then you have all of a sudden the thing that makes the game exciting is no longer as exciting because there's no anticipation that it might not happen. I know
but
that
there is still the anticipation of a turnover. Like I heard, and I'll plug another athletic podcast, the Athletic Football Show with Robert Mays and Nate Tice. They were talking about the Chiefs, and it was really interesting because they were talking about the Chiefs defense. The Chiefs offense is so good that the Chiefs defense is willing to take more chances, whereas very few teams in the NFL would play cover zero against an empty backfield. The Chiefs will, because they're going to, first of all, they've repped it in practice. So they know what they need to do. Everybody knows what their assignment is. And if you guess right, you are going to beat them. Like you will find a hot receiver and you will gain some yards, and that's cool. But they're betting that you're not going to guess right every time. Mm-hmm. And that you might throw it into coverage and it might get picked off. And having Tyrann Mathieu, who's very versatile, a very smart defensive player who, once the ball gets snapped, is very good at figuring out what the offense is doing and then moving to stop it. I mean, you can do that stuff on defense.
Yeah.
It's not a hopeless cause just because you can't hold them to 1.9 yards a play anymore. It's just different.
Yeah. I still like my idea if you get a point for it. I think stops have become so hard. I think you throw an interesting dynamic into the game, especially in close games. If you could swing a game by getting a stop here or there. I know you're not up for my idea. And I definitely like the idea of less punting. The strange dynamic with me is I love punters, but I hate punting.
I would keep the punters because I would eliminate the kickoff. I would make the kickoff a scrimmage punt if you wanted to kick it, or you could just run a play, and if you gained whatever yardage we decided, you can keep the ball. You know, maybe this 15 yards or whatever. Because the punt is a much safer play than the kickoff.
Right.
Why? Because because
you're not getting
punt
a running
return team
head
shadows, yeah. shadows the gunners down the field, as opposed to everybody has a 30 yard right. running start and they slam into each other.
So the next time you go on Twitter, because when Andy also, you know, and if anybody's listening to this, I'm sure they followed me and Andy on Twitter, but nonetheless, and next time you go on Twitter, because when you do, you usually start fights and quote tweet people.
No, I don't start fights. I finish fights, Ralph. People start fights with me.
But when you do and you bring up this topic, because I've had this topic on Twitter where I've said, listen, the kickoff is ridiculous. We got to get rid of the kickoff. And a whole bunch of folks come at me and they start throwing at, well, what about the you know, Saban, you know, kicking that onside kick and that? How important was the kickoff then? Listen. One out of every 500 yeah. kickoffs are important. We can live without
them. It's super important, but they've also changed the rules of the onside kick to make it almost impossible to recover right. for safety reasons.
Right.
So how about instead of worrying about how some ex-soccer player kicks an oblong ball and then it bounces on a field made of rubber pellets, you just have some football players run a football play.
Yes. Play football.
And if they gain 15 yards, they keep the ball. And if they don't, they don't. Pretty simple.
And that'd be another good change for college football. While we're changing college football, let's do that. Andy, I think that's all I got for you today. I'm going to let you go back to your... See, also, Andy has been tweeting during the show.
What?
You have been tweeting...
How dare you, Ralph? How dare you break the fourth wall like
you
this?
You have been tweeting during the show, and of course...
Well, it was a very important question somebody asked.
You're tweeting food takes.
In honor of the Chiefs. What do I make in honor of Tampa? And I'm like... What do you mean? You make some roast pork and Maduro's and Moro rice. You make Cuban sandwiches.
I know you'll never believe this, but not far from where I live in Brooklyn, one of the best Cuban sandwiches I've ever had.
Oh, I would absolutely believe that.
Yeah, next time you're ever up in this part of the country, I'm taking it, and it's not even like a restaurant. It's just a walk up. Place. It's a storefront. You order. They've got a very small menu. They have a few sandwiches, a few things non-sandwich related, and it's been near me for years. I've lived not far away from this place for years. I always see it and go, I got to try that place. I got to try it. Finally, last year during the pandemic, I tried the place, and now I go, I would say once a month, only because if I did more than that, it would probably be unhealthy.
That's the thing. I am making feijoada today. I don't know if you've ever had feijoada. I have not had it. I watched something on TV about it and I said, oh my God, that looks amazing.
What is feijoada?
So it's a Brazilian dish. It's a black bean and meat stew. And the meat can be kind of whatever you want it to be. I think the idea in Brazil is every part of the pig just goes in there. Once the choice cuts are gone, you sort of put all the rest of the pig.
Right, because that's what you want to do with the stew, right? You don't
very
want
much
you
like
want
barbecue
waste,
in America.
Yeah, where, you don't want to waste the best parts on a stew. You want to use those on their own.
Yeah. I mean, barbecue in America evolved because people were given the bad cuts of meat and they had to figure out how to make them taste great, and they did. And so that just watching it was amazing. It looks so good. So I've made my ham stock. I did that last night. I soaked my beans. I've got to brown my meat. I am actually going to brown my meat over smoke and see if I can get a little smoke flavor in there too before I then put everything back in the pot. But I've got pork belly. I've got chorizo. I've got just some pork chunk stew meat. I've got some beef stew meat.
Will you use a regular pot or will you throw this in an Instapot?
No, I'm going to use
you
a regular
slow,
pot.
You got to slow.
I'm not sure about the pressure. Yeah, I haven't seen a lot of pressure cooker versions of this, and right. I kind of want to do it the normal way first, and then figure out. But then you serve it with a big bowl of rice, and then they make
that sounds delicious.
They make a thing where they take the flour that you would use to make yucca. They kind of roast that in pork fat, and so that's sort of a topping, like a ground topping almost. And so I think it's called. oh, I'm going to mess it up. I think it's called Farofa, I believe. And so I got to try to make that too and see how that turns out.
No, I'm hungry and I can't make that for my vegan wife. So
no, this is the most anti-vegan meal ever conceived.
My daughter is no longer a vegetarian though. She broke the wall. Well, she just decided that she wanted. The funny thing though is
what brought her back to the land of the omnivores, Ralph?
I think honestly it was fast food. It was more of like, chicken fingers and stuff like that. Yeah, it was fast food. But the funny thing is, so she still has not completely embraced eating meat. Like if you put a steak in front of her, she's like, is that the blood?
So yes, it was an animal. It has blood. It bleeds its own blood.
Like, so she's more likely to eat a chicken finger because that doesn't actually look like what it is, right?
Right.
The funny thing is last week I gave her a pork. I guess a pork chop, but it was more a boneless pork loin, chops. And I realized that my 14-year-old daughter, because she has been a vegetarian for so long, doesn't really know how to cut her own meat. She's like hacking at this poor piece of meat as if.
And pork loin, usually very tender, like
it was
a butter knife.
So tender. It was so tender. Yeah. And we had a friend of hers over, and even the friend is like cutting the meat into like nice small pieces and like eating properly and is looking over at my daughter like, why don't you know how to cut your own meat, Sophia? Because she hasn't ever done it. I don't think she's ever done it.
That's all right. I mean, listen, if you're a new meat eater, it's okay to eat like a cave person.
Yeah.
Understandable. Get that girl a turkey leg.
No, and I told her what I need now is I need the bone in pork chops so she can just pick it up.
Yeah. So I want to see her eat it like a Viking.
Just like rip it apart and dig into it. So again, what are you making? What's the name of the thing you're making again? Because I might have to hit you up
for
the
recipe.
It's
called feijoada. It's a Brazilian dish, but as you'd expect with things from Brazil, they also make in Portugal, but I believe they also make it in some African countries too. So I'm fascinated by this and I have no idea if mine is going to taste representative of anybody else's. I've never been to Brazil, so hopefully it'll turn out good and I'll have a new dish that I can make for the fam.
Gotcha. So, all right. So we've run 10 minutes over because we had to talk about food. Next time you're online and you get into a fight about the kickoff, I want in on that because I'm totally down with that. So we'll definitely be in on your side on the kickoff fights on Twitter. Andy, always a pleasure catching up. Always great to see you in person, which we managed to do at the playoff. And, you know, have a good quote unquote off season.
There is no off season, Ralph. We can always find something to yell about.
Now three and out. First down. Last week, the NFL released a list of players who have decided to enter the draft as underclassmen. 98 players were granted special eligibility. That number has dropped a little bit in the last couple of years. It was up over 100 for a few years straight. But don't be misled. The number of players who are leaving school with eligibility on the table is still really high. And has stayed very high for a while now, well over 100. The difference in recent years is the number of players leaving school after having graduated in fewer than 4 years has been going up. This year, 30 players fell into that category, including Penn State's Micah Parsons, who opted out of the 2020 season. Alabama quarterback Mac Jones, a player who had redshirted as a freshman and had spent 4 years at Alabama. And Texas tackle Samuel Cosmi, Ohio State defensive back Sean Wade also fell into the category of having eligibility left, but also having finished their degree. So they didn't necessarily need a special waiver from the NFL to move on to the draft. There is no reason to complain about players graduating early. Graduation is a good thing. Early graduation is a really good thing. But it's important to understand that the current blueprint of getting freshmen to early enroll in college has played a huge part in accelerating the careers of college football players and creating more roster volatility than ever before. Because the other thing that happens when players graduate early is that they get to grad transfer sooner, often with 2, even 3 years of eligibility left. We've already seen an uptick on players transferring multiple times, and that's before the one-time exception becomes NCAA law. As of now, there are no immediate plans to tweak the grad transfer rule, though my sense is that could be something that gets looked at down the road. To be clear, I'm not complaining about any of this. Players deserve freedom to move just like regular students have and just like coaches have. But I think it's also important to understand that when coaches complain about player movement, how the whole process from recruitment to jumping to the NFL has been sped up, their actions have contributed to the churn. They created and cultivated the early enrollment model, and now it's giving players more options and more power than they've ever had. Second down, we know which underclassmen have entered the draft, and we're still piecing together what upperclassmen might decide to take advantage of the NCAA's extra year of eligibility for playing through a pandemic. I've mentioned this on the show before previously, but I think it could be a boon to some of what I would call the middle class, the upper middle class programs who could fortify their depth charts with fifth and sixth year seniors who have only marginal NFL value or NFL futures, but whose experience and development make them very valuable college football players. I hope to scour the rosters in the next couple of weeks and get a hard count on what schools might benefit most from bringing upperclassmen back next year. I wouldn't be surprised at all if we see a couple of quote unquote surprise teams in 2021 who are buoyed by a core of extra year players. Third down, and now a little bit of a personal note. So I mentioned to Andy that I had deleted Twitter from my phone in recent days, and I actually watched the NFL conference championship games without Twitter as a second screen. It's been years since I've done that, and I found it pretty enjoyable. I definitely miss some of the back and forth. I always say Twitter is like sort of hanging out in a sports bar, right? You get to share your dopey opinions and hear other people's dopey opinions in real time, or just shout about, wow, what a great play. It's a neat experience to watch games that way, and I've always enjoyed it. And I watched the first couple of weeks of playoff games that way, but I decided to go without it for this particular playoff game, or for these particular playoff games. Unlike Andy, I haven't done a good job of monitoring and controlling my usage of social media, especially Twitter. It really has taken a toll on me, frankly. I waste a lot of time. I have a hard time relaxing when I'm not on there and constantly being dragged back on. And I become disengaged from other people and other tasks by all the time I spend on social media. A lot of that came about this year because the season was so weird, and the season was really starting back in the off season of July and August, trying to figure out if there was going to be a season. So I was more engaged with Twitter because of work than ever before. This season, I became more in tune to what was going on around the country than ever before, because every day there seemed to be more news. And as I plunged deeper and deeper into it, I found myself wasting even more time, having a hard time focusing on the tasks at hand of writing and reporting. It became, quite frankly, a really uncomfortable way to live. So I needed to go cold turkey. I needed to get it out of my life for at least a few weeks. If you have seen that Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma, you know social media apps are made to be addictive, and I really needed some time in rehab. My plan is to go without Twitter, Twitter free, until the Super Bowl. That would be a couple of weeks from now. Though work might make it difficult to stick with that plan, you know, when things start hopping in college football, as much as I've been trying to take a little time off, Twitter is part of the deal. If you're a loyal listener who also follows me on Twitter at Ralph D. Russo AP, you'll notice my account, my timeline has been pretty dark lately, and I plan to keep it that way for a while. And I would recommend a prolonged break for anyone who finds themselves spending a lot of time on social media, Twitter in particular. Mentally and physically, I've been feeling a whole lot better with less Twitter. That's the show for today. I'd like to thank my producer, Sarah McCrory, for making me sound good. You can find this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Westwood One Podcasts. Please subscribe so you do not miss an episode. I'm Ralph Russo, the college football writer with the Associated Press. Thanks for listening, and come back for more next week of the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast.